Welcome to the Rec Network. I am Kit, and I am going to read you a story today. Can you let me know if the levels are okay for reading a story right now? The story is going to be Burning Chrome. The music is meant to be background the entire way. Alright, nobody has input. We'll just do it live. Fuck it, we'll do it live. Burning Chrome by William Gibson. It was hot the night we burned chrome. Out in the malls and plazas, moths were batting themselves to death against the neon. But in Bobby's loft, the only light came from a monitor screen and the green and red LEDs on the face of the Matrix simulator. I knew every chip in Bobby's simulator by heart. It looked like your workaday Ono Sendai 7, the Cyberspace 7, but I'd rebuilt it so many times that you'd had a hard time finding a square millimeter of factory circuitry in all that silicon. We waited side by side in front of the simulator console, watching the time display in the screen's lower left corner. "Go for it," I said when it was time, but Bobby was already there, leaning forward to drive the Russian program into its slot with the heel of his hand. He did it with the tight grace of a kid slamming change into an arcade game, sure of winning and ready to pull down a string of free games. A silver tide of phosphines boiled across my field of vision as the Matrix began to unfold in my head. A 3D chessboard, infinite and perfectly transparent. The Russian program seemed to lurch as we entered the grid. If anyone else had been jacked into that part of the Matrix, he might have seen a surf of flickering shadow roll out of the little yellow pyramid that represented our computer. The program was a mimetic weapon, designed to absorb local color and present itself as a crash priority override in whatever context it encountered. "Congratulations," I heard Bobby say. "We just became an Eastern Seaboard Fission Authority inspection probe." That meant we were clearing fiber optic lines with the cybernetic equivalent of a fire siren. But in the simulation matrix, we seemed to rush straight for Chrome's database. I couldn't see it yet, but I already knew those walls were waiting. Walls of shadow. Walls of ice. Chrome, her pretty child's face smooth as steel, with eyes that would have been at home in the bottom of some deep Atlantic trench. Cold gray eyes that lived under terrible pressure. This SID she cooked her own cancers for people who crossed her. Rococo custom variations that took years to kill you. They said a lot of things about Chrome. None of them were all that reassuring. So I blotted her out with a picture of Ricky. Ricky kneeling in a shaft of dusty sunlight that slanted into the loft through a grid of steel and glass. She faded camouflage fatigues, her translucent rose sandals, the good line of her bare back as she rummaged through a nylon gear bag. She looks up, and a half-blonde curl falls to tickle her nose, smiling, buttoning an old shirt of Bobby's, frayed khaki cut and drawn across her breasts. She smiles. "Son of a bitch," said Bobby. "We just told Chrome we're an IRS audit and three Supremes... court subpoenas. Hang on to your ass, Jack. So long, Ricky. Maybe now I see you never." And dark, so dark, in the halls of Chrome's ice. Bobby was a cowboy, and ice was the nature of his game. Ice from ice, intrusion countermeasures electronics. The Matrix is an abstract representation of the relationships between data systems. Legitimate programmers jack into their employer's sector of the Matrix and find themselves surrounded by the bright geometries representing the corporate data. Towers and fields of it ranged in the colorless non-space of the simulation matrix, the electronic consensus hallucination that facilitates the handling and exchange of the massive quantities of data. Legitimate programmers never see the walls of ice they work behind, the walls of shadow that their screen operations that screen their operations from others, from industrial espionage artists and hustlers like Bobby Quinn. Bobby was a cowboy. Bobby was a cracksman, a burglar, causing mankind's extended electronic nervous system, rustling data and credit in the crowded matrix, monochrome non-space where the only stars are dense concentrations of information. And high above it all, burn corporate galaxies and the cold spiral arms of military systems. Bobby was another one of those young old faces you see drinking in the Gentleman's Looser, the chic bar for computer cowboys, rustlers, cybernetic second-story men. We were partners. Bobby Quinn and the Automatic Jack. Bobby's the thin, pale dude with the dark glasses, and Jack's the mean-looking guy with the myoelectric arm. Bobby's software and Jack's hard. Bobby punches console and Jack runs down all the little things that can give you an edge. Or anyway, that's what the scene watchers in the Gentleman's Losers would have told you before Bobby decided to burn chrome. But they also might have told you that Bobby was losing his edge, slowing down. He was 28, Bobby, and that's old for a console cowboy. Both of us were good at what we did, but somehow that one big score just wouldn't come down for us. I knew where to go for the right gear, and Bobby had all of his licks down pat. He'd sit back with a white terry sweatband across his forehead and whip moves on those keyboards faster than you could follow, punching his way through some of the fanciest ice in the business. But that's when something happened that managed to get him totally wired, and that didn't happen often. Not highly motivated, Bobby, and I was the kind of guy who was happy to have the rent covered and a clean shirt to wear. But Bobby had this thing for girls. They were like his private tarot or something. The way he'd get himself moving. We never talked about it, but when it started to look like he was losing that touch that summer, he started to spend more time in the Gentleman Looser. He'd sit at a table by the open doors and watch the crowd slide by. Nights when the bugs were at the neon and the air smelled of perfume and fast food. You could see his sunglasses scanning those faces as they passed, and they must have decided that Ricky's was the one he was waiting for, the wild card and the luck changer, the new one. I went to New York to check out the market to see what was available in hot software. The Finn's place had a defective hologram in the window, Metro Holographics, over a display of dead flies wearing fur coats of grey dust. The scraps waist-high inside, with drifts of it is rising to meet the walls that are barely visible behind nameless junk, behind sagging pressboard shelves stacked with old skin magazines and yellow-spined years of National Geographic. "You need a gun," said Finn. He looks like a recumbo DNA project aimed at tailoring people for high-speed burrowing. "You're in luck. I've got a new Smith & Wesson, the 408 Tactical. Got this Sennin projector slung under the barrel, see? Batteries in the grip. Throw your 12-inch high noon circle in the pitch dark at 50 yards. The light source is so narrow, it's almost impossible to spot. It's like voodoo in the night fight." I let my arm clunk down on the table and started the fingers drumming. The servos in the hand began whining like overworked mosquitoes. I knew that Finn really hated the sound. "You looking to pawn that?" he prodded, the Duralumin wrist joint with the chewed shaft of a felt tip pen. "Maybe get you something a little quieter?" I kept it up. "I don't need any guns, Finn." "Okay," he said, "okay," and I quit drumming. "I only got this one item, and I don't even know what it is." He looked unhappy. "I got these off-bridge and tunnel kids from New Jersey last week. So when you'd ever buy anything, you didn't know what it was, Finn?" "Wise ass," and he passed me a transparent mailer with something in it that looked like an audio cassette through the bubble padding. "They had a passport," he said. "They had credit cards and a watch. And that." "They had the contents of somebody's pockets, you mean?" He nodded. "The passport was Belgian. It was also bogus." He looked to me, so I put it in the furnace, put the cards in with it. The watch was okay. A Porsche. Nice watch. It was obviously some kind of plug-in military program. Out of the mailer, it looked like the magazine of a small assault rifle, coated with non-reflective black plastic. The edges and corners showed bright metal, and had been knocking around for a while. I'll give you sake. You a bargain on it. Jack, for old times, and I had to smile at that, getting a bargain from Finn was like God repealing the law of gravity when you have to carry a heavy suitcase down 10 blocks of airport corridor. Looks Russian to me, I said. Probably the emergency sewage controls from some Leningrad suburb. Just what I need. You know, said Finn, I got a pair of shoes older than you are. Sometimes I think you got about as much class as those yahoos from Jersey. What do you want me to tell you? It's the keys to the Kremlin? You figure out what the goddamn thing is. Me? I just sell stuff. I bought it. Bodiless, we swerve into Chrome's castle of ice, and we're fast. Fast. It feels like we're surfing the crest of the invading program, hanging 10 above the seething glitch systems as they mutate. We're sentient patches of oil swept along the corridors of shadow. Somewhere, we have bodies, very far away, in a crowded roof, loft, roofed with steel and glass. Somewhere, we have microseconds, maybe time to pull out. We crash her gates disguised as an audit and 3 subpoenas, but her defenses are specifically geared to cope with that kind of official intrusion. Her most sophisticated ICE is structured to fend off warrants, writs, and subpoenas. When we breached the first gate, the bulk of her data vanished behind the core command ICE. These walls we see as leagues of corridor, mazes of shadow. 5 separate landlines spurted Mayday signals to law firms, but the virus had already taken over the perimeter ICE. The glitch systems gobble the distress calls as our mimetic sub-programs scan anything that hasn't been blanked by the core command. The Russian program lifts a Tokyo number from the on-screen data, choosing it for frequency of calls, average length of calls, the speed of which Chrome returned those calls. Okay, says Bobby, we're an incoming scrambler call from a pal of hers in Japan. That should help. Ride him, cowboy. Bobby read his future in women. His girls were omens, changes in the weather, and he'd sit all night with the gentleman sluicer, waiting for the season to lay a new face down in front of him like a card. I was working late, in the loft one night, shaving down a chip, my arm off, and a little Waldo's jacked straight into the stump. Bobby came in with a girl I hadn't seen before, and I usually feel a little funny if a stranger sees me working that way, with those leads clipped to the hard carbon studs that stick out of my stump. She came right over and looked to at the magnified image on the screen. She saw the Waldo moving under its vacuum-sealed dust cover. She didn't say anything, just watched. Right away, I had a good feeling about her. It's like that sometimes. Automatic Jack, Ricky, my associate. He laughed, put his arm around her waist, something in his tone letting me know that I'd be spending the night in a dingy room in a hotel. Hi, she said, tall, 19, maybe 20, and she definitely had the goods, with just those few freckles across the bridge of her nose and eyes somewhere between dark and amber and French coffee. Tight black jeans rolled to mid-calf and narrow plastic belt that matched those rose-colored sandals. But now when I see her sometimes, when I'm trying to sleep, I see her somewhere on the edge of all this sprawl of cities and smoke, and it's like she's a hologram stuck behind my eyes in a bright dress she must have worn once when I knew her. Something that doesn't quite reach her knees. Bare legs, long and straight. Brown hair, streaked with blonde. Hoods of her face, blown in a wind from somewhere, and I see her wave goodbye. Bobby was making a show of rooting through a stack of audio cassettes. I'm on the way, cowboy, I said, unclipping the Waldo. She watched attentively as I put my arm back on. Can you fix things? She asked. Anything. Anything you want. Automatic Jack will fix it. And I snapped my Duralumin fingers for her. She took a little sim-stim deck from her belt and showed me the broken hinge on the cassette cover. Tomorrow, I said, no problem. Oh, and my oh my, I said to myself, sleep pulling me down 6 flights to the street. What'll Bobby's luck be with that fortune cookie? If his system worked, we'll be striking rich right now. In the street, I grinned and yawned and waved for a cab. Chrome's castle is dissolving. Sheets of ice, shadow flickering and fading, eaten by the glitch system that spin out from the Russian program, tumbling away from our central logic thrust and infecting the fabric of the ice itself. The glitch systems are cybernetic virus analogs, self-replicating and voracious. They mutate constantly, in unison, subverting and absorbing Chrome's defenses. Have we already paralyzed her? Or is the bell ringing somewhere, a red light blinking? Does she know? Ricky Wildside, Bobby called her, and for the first few weeks it must have seemed to her that she had it all. The whole teeming show spread out for her, sharp and bright under the neon. She was new to the scene, and she had all the miles of malls and plazas to prowl, and all the shops and clubs. And Bobby to explain the wild side, the tricky wiring on the dark underside of things, and all the players and their names and their games. He made her feel at home. What happened to your arm? She asked me one night in The Gentleman Loser, the three of us drinking at a small table in a corner. Hang gliding, I said. Accident. Hang gliding over a wheat field, said Bobby. Place called Kiev. Our Jack's just hanging there in the dark, under a Nightwing parafoil, with 50 kilos of radar jammed between his legs, and some Russian asshole accidentally burns his arms off with a laser. I don't remember how I changed the subject, but I did. I was still telling myself that it wasn't Ricky who was getting to me, but what Bobby was doing with her. I'd known him for a long time, and since the end of the war, and I knew he used women as counters in a game. Bobby Quinn versus Fortune versus Time and the Night of the Cities. And Ricky had turned up just when he needed something to get him going, something to aim for. So he'd set her up as a symbol for everything he wanted and couldn't have, everything he'd had and couldn't keep. I didn't like having to listen to him tell me how much he loved her, and knowing he believed it only made it worse. He was a past master at the hard fall of the rapid recovery, and I'd seen it happen a dozen times before. He might as well have had Next printed across his sunglasses in the green DGB capitals, ready to flash out at the first interesting face that flowed past the tables of The Gentleman's Loser. I knew what he did to them. He turned them into emblems, sigils on the map of his hustler life. Navigation beacons he could follow through a sea of bars and neon. What else did he have to steer by? He didn't love money, in and of itself, not enough to follow its lights. He wouldn't work for overpower, over people. He hated the responsibility it brings. He had some basic pride in his skill, but that was never enough to keep him pushing. So he made do with women. When Ricky showed up, he needed the one in the worst way. He was fading fast, and smart money was already whispering that the edge was off his game. He needed that one big score, and soon, because he didn't know any other kind of life, and all his clocks were set for hustler's time, calibrated in risk and adrenaline, that supernatural dawn calm that comes every move's proved right. Comes when every move's proved right and a sweet lump of someone else's credit clicks into your own account. It was time for him to make his bundle and get out, so Ricky got set up higher and farther away than any of the others ever had. Even though, and I felt like screaming it at him, she was right there, alive, totally real, human, hungry, resilient, bored, beautiful, excited, all the things she was. When he went out one afternoon, about a week before I made the trip to New York to see Finn, went out and left us there in the loft waiting for a thunderstorm. Half the skylight was shadowed by a dome they'd never finished, and the other half showed sky, black and blue with clouds. I was standing by the bench looking up at that sky, stupid with the hot afternoon, the humidity, and she touched me. Touched my shoulder, the half-inch border of taut pink scar that the arm doesn't cover. Anybody else ever touched me there, they went on the shoulder, on the neck. But she didn't do that. Her nails were lacquered black, not pointed, but tapered oblongs. The lacquer only a shade darker than the carbon fiber laminate that sheathes my arm. and her hand went down the arm, black nails tracing a weld in the laminate, down to the black anodized elbow joint, out to the wrist. Her hand soft-knuckled as a child's, fingers spreading out to lock over mine, her palm against the perforated duralumin. Her other palm came up to brush across the feedback pads, and it rained all afternoon, raindrops drumming on the steel and soot-stained glass above Bobby's bed. Ice walls flick away like supersonic butterflies, made of shade. Beyond them, the matrix illusion of infinite space is like watching a tape of prefab building going up, only the tapes reversed and run at high speed. These walls are torn wings. Trying to remind myself that this place and the gulfs beyond are only representations and that we aren't in Chrome's computer but interfaced with it, while the matrix simulator in Bobby's loft generates this illusion. The core data begin to emerge, exposed, vulnerable. This is the far side of ice, the view of the matrix I've never seen before, the view that 15 million legitimate console operators see daily and take for granted. The core data tower around us like vertical freight trains, color-coded for access, bright primaries, impossibly bright in the transparent void, linked by countless horizontals in nursery blues and pinks. But the ice still shadows something at the center of it all, the heart of all Chrome's expensive darkness, the very heart. It was late afternoon when I got back from my shopping expedition to New York. Not much sun through the skylight, but an ice pattern glowed on Bobby's monitor screen, a 2D graphic representation of someone's computer defenses, lines of neon woven like an Art Deco prayer rug. I turned the console off and the screen went completely dark. Ricky's things were spread across my workbench, nylon bags spilling clothes and makeup, a pair of bright red cowboy boots, audio cassettes, glossy Japanese magazines about SimStim stars. I stacked it all under the bench and then took my arm off, forgetting that the program I'd bought from Finn was in the right-hand pocket of my jacket, so that I had to fumble it out left-handed and then get it into the padded jaws of the jeweler's wife. The Waldo looks like an old audio turntable, the kind that played disc records, with the vice set up under a transparent dust cover. The arm itself is just over a centimeter long, swinging out with what would have been the tone arm on one of those turntables. But I don't look at that when I've clipped the leads to my stump. I look at the scope, because that's my arm, there in black and white, magnification 40 times. I ran a tool check and picked up the laser. It felt a little heavy, so I scaled my weight sensor input down to a quarter kilo per gram and got to work. At 40 times magnification, the side of the program looked like a trailer truck. It took 8 hours to crack, 3 hours with the Waldo and the laser and 4 dozen taps, 2 hours on the phone to a contact in Colorado, and 3 hours to run down a lexicon disk that could translate 8-year-old technical Russian. When Cyrillic alphanumeric started reeling down on the monitor, twisting themselves into English halfway down, there was a lot of gaps, and the lexicon ray. And the lexicon ran up against specialized military acronyms in the readout I'd bought from my man in Colorado, but it did give me some idea of what I'd bought from the Finn. I felt like a punk who'd gone out to buy a switchblade and come home with a small neutron bomb. Screwed again, I thought. What good's a neutron bomb in a street fight? The thing under the dust cover was right out of my league. I didn't even know where to unload it, where to look for a buyer. Someone had, but he was dead. Someone with a Porsche watch and a fake Belgian passport. But I had never tried to move in those circles. The Finn's muggers from the burbs had knocked over someone who had some highly arcane connections. The program in the jeweler's vice was a Russian military icebreaker, a killer virus program. It was dawn when Bobby came in alone. I'd fallen asleep with a bag of takeout sandwiches in my lap. "You want to eat?" I asked him, not really awake, holding out my sandwiches. I'd been dreaming of the program, of its waves of hungry glitch systems and mimetic subprograms, In the dream, it was an animal of some kind, shapeless and flowing. He brushed the bag aside on his way to the console, punched a function key. The screen lit with intricate pattern I'd seen there that afternoon. I rubbed sleep from my eyes with my left hand, and one thing I can't do with my right. I'd fallen asleep, trying to decide whether to tell him about the program. Maybe I should try to sell it alone, keep the money, go somewhere new, ask Ricky to go with me. "Whose is it?" I asked. He stood there in the black cotton jumpsuit, an old leather jacket thrown over his shoulders like a cape. He hadn't shaved for a few days, and his face looked thinner than usual. "It's Chrome's," he said. My arm convulsed, started clicking, fear translated to the myoelectrics through the carbon studs. I spilled the sandwiches, limp sprouts, and bright yellow dairy produce slices went unswept of wooden floor. "You're stone crazy," I said. "Nah," he said. "You think she rumbled it? No way. We'd be dead already." I locked on to her through a triple-blind rental system in Mombasa and an Algerian comsat. She knew somebody was having a look-see, but she couldn't trace it. If Chrome had traced the pass Bobby had made at her ice, we were as good as dead. But he was probably right, or she'd have blown me away on the way back from New York. "Why her, Bobby? Just give me one reason." Chrome. I'd seen her maybe a half dozen times in The Gentleman Loser. Maybe she was slumming or checking out the human condition, a condition she didn't exactly aspire to. A sweet little heart-shaped face framing the nastiest pair of eyes you ever saw. She looked 14 for as long as anyone could remember, hyped out of anything as a normal metabolism on some massive program of serums and hormones. She was as ugly as a customer as the street ever produced. But she didn't belong to the street anymore. She was one of the boys. Chrome, a member in good standing of the local mob subsidiary. Word was she'd gotten started as a dealer, back when synthetic pituitary hormones were still prescribed. But she hadn't had to move hormones for a long time. Now she owned the House of Blue Lights. "You're flat out crazy, Quinn. You give me one sane reason for having that stuff on your screen. You ought to dump it, and I mean now." "Talking the loser," he said, shrugging off the leather jacket. "Black Myron and Crow Jane. Jane, she's up on all the sex lines. Claims she knows where the money goes. So she's arguing with Myron that Chrome's the controlling interest in the blue lights, not some figurehead for the boys." "The boys, Bobby," I said. "That's the operative word there. You're still capable of seeing that? We don't mess with the boys, remember? That's why we're still walking around." "And that's why we're still poor, partner." He settled back into the swivel chair in front of the console, unzipped his jumpsuit, and scratched his skinny white chest. "But maybe not for much longer. I think maybe this partnership just got itself permanently dissolved." Then he grinned at me. The grin was truly crazy, feral, focused. I knew that right then he didn't really give a shit about dying. "Look," I said, "I've got some money left, you know? Why don't you take it and get to the tube to Miami, catch a hopper to Montego Bay? You need a rest, man. You gotta get your act together." "My act, Jack," he said, punching something on the keyboard. "Never has been this together before." The neon prayer rug on the screen shivered and woke as an animation program cut in, ice lines weaving with hypnotic frequency, a living mandala. Bobby kept punching, and the movement slowed. The pattern resolved itself, grew slightly less complex, became an alternation between two distant configurations, a first-class piece of work, and I hadn't thought he was still that good. "Now," he said, "there, see it? Wait, there, there again, and there, easy to miss, that's it, cuts in every hour and 20 minutes with a squirt transmission from the comsat. We could live for a year on that." He pays them weekly in negative interest. "Whose comsat?" "Zurich, her banker's. That's her bank book, Jack, that's where the money goes. Crow Jane was right." I stood there, my arm forgot to click. "So how'd you do in New York, partner? You get anything that'll help me cut ice? We're going to need whatever we can get." I kept my eyes on his, forced myself not to look in the direction of the Waldo, the jeweler's vice, The Russian program was there under the dust cover. Wild cards, luck changers. "Where's Ricky?" I asked him, crossing to the console, pretending to study alternating patterns on the screen. "Friends of hers?" he shrugged. "Kids, they're all into SimStim," he smiled absently. "I'm going to do it for her, man. I'm going out to think about this, Bobby. You want me to come back? You keep your hands off the board." "I'm doing it for her," he said, as the door closed behind me. "You know Lim." And down the program, a roller coaster through this fraying maze of shadow walls, gray cathedral spaces between bright towers, headlong speed. Black ice, don't think about it, black ice. Too many stories in The Gentleman Looser. Black ice is a part of the mythology. Ice that kills, illegal, but then, aren't we all? Some kind of neural feedback weapon, and you can connect it with only once, like some hideous word that eats the mind from the inside out, like an epileptic spasm that goes on and on until there's nothing left at all. Nothing left at all. And we're driving for the floor of the Chrome Shadow Castle, trying to brace myself for the sudden stopping of breath, the sickness, a final slackening of the nerves, fear of that cold word waiting down there in the dark. I went out and looked for Ricky, found her in a cafe with a boy with Sendai eyes, half-healed suture lines radiating from his bruised sockets. She had a glossy brochure spread open on the table, Tali Isham, smiling up from a dozen photographs, the girl with the size icon eyes. Her little SimStim deck was one of the things I'd stacked under my bench the night before, the one I'd fixed for her the day after I'd first seen her. She spent hours jacked into that unit, the contact band across her face like a grey plastic tiara. Tali Isham was her favourite, and with the contact band on, she was gone, off somewhere in the recorded sensorium of SimStim's biggest star. Simulated stimuli, the world of all interesting parts. Anyway, as perceived by Tali Isham. Tali raced a black fucker ground effect plane across Arizona Mesa tops. Tali dived in the Truck Island preserves. Tali partied with the super rich on private Greek islands. Heartbreaking purity of those tiny white seaports at dawn. Actually, she looked a lot like Tali. Same coloring and cheekbones. I thought Ricky's mouth was stronger. More sass. She didn't want to be the Tali Isham, but she coveted the job. It was her ambition to be SimStim. Bobby just laughed it off. She talked to me about it, though. How do I look with a pair of these? She'd ask, holding a full-page headshot, Tali Isham's blue size icon lined up with her own amber brown. She had her corneas done twice, but she still wasn't 2020, so she wanted icons. Brand of the stars, very expensive. "You still want window shopping for eyes?" I asked as I sat down. "Tiger got some," she said. She looked tired, I thought. Tiger was so pleased with his Sendai's that he couldn't help smiling, but I doubted whether he'd have smiled otherwise. He had the kind of uniform good looks you get after your seventh trip to the surgical boutique. He'd probably spend the rest of his life looking vaguely like each new season's media frontrunner. Not too obvious a copy, but nothing too original either. "Sendai, right?" I smiled back. He nodded. I watched as he tried to take me in with his idea of a professional SimStim glance. He was pretending that he was recording. I thought he spent too long on my arm. They'll be great on peripherals when the muscles heal, he said, and I saw how carefully he reached for his double espresso. Sendai eyes are notorious for depth perception defects and warranty hassles, among other things. "Tiger's leaving for Hollywood tomorrow. Then maybe Chiba City, right?" I smiled at him. He didn't smile back. "Got an offer, Tiger. Know an agent?" "Just checking it out," he said quietly. He got up and left. He said a quick goodbye to Ricky, but not to me. That kid's optic nerves may start to deteriorate inside 6 months. You know that, Ricky? Those Sendais are illegal in England, Denmark, and lots of places. You can't replace nerves. "Hey, Jack, no lectures." She stole one of my croissants and nibbled at the top of one of its horns. "I thought I was your advisor, kid." "Yeah, well, Tiger's not too swift, but everyone knows about Sendai's. They're all he can afford, so he's taking a chance. If he gets work, he can replace them. With these? I tapped Sai's icon brochure. Lots of money, Ricky. You know better than to take a gamble like that. She nodded. I want icons. If you're going up to Bobby's, tell him to sit tight until he hears from... Sure, it's a business? Business, I said. But it was craziness. I drank my coffee and she ate both my croissants. Then I walked her down to Bobby's. I made 15 calls, each one from a different payphone. Business. Bad craziness. All in all, it took us 6 weeks to set the burn up. 6 weeks of Bobby telling me how much he loved her. I worked even harder trying to get away from that. Much of it was phone calls. My 15 initial and very oblique inquiries each seemed like to breed 15 more. I was looking for a certain service Bobby and I imagined as a requisite for the part for the world's clandestine economy, but which probably never had more than 5 customers at a time. It would be one that would never advertised. That was about half an hour's stream. We're about halfway through the story. I will continue it at maybe tomorrow. I hope you enjoyed it. I do apologize for any slip-ups, but it was a pretty bad skin. See you later.